because he's good. Now give yourselves a hand, because you did a good job on that. But we're just going to enter into more of a reflective time this morning, and I want to invite you just to enter along in with us. Take the opportunity in your heart to make these songs just prayerful and give it all over to God. That I speak, and the thoughts that are in our hearts, and make everything holy and acceptable to you. For you're our rock, you're our redeemer. We love you. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, over the summer, I have been a fan of a particular TV show called Kitchen Nightmares. Have you seen this show? It's got Chef Gordon Ramsay, the meanest chef on television. And you think, if you've never seen the show, I have to set it up, because Gordon Ramsay is a sailor in the mouth. He is, but it's on network television. I mean, it's on Fox. And even though network TV today is far different than it was years and years ago, there's still some measure of censorship. And so if you watch the show, you see repeatedly, time and time again, the mouths move, and yet the sound coming out of their mouths goes like this. Beep! And it's incessant. So you watch the show, and if you don't know anything about the show, you're just going to hear beep, 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 beep the whole time. Well, in the midst of all the beeping, there is some storyline. And this last week, it was a reality episode about a guy named Sebastian who owned a restaurant. And every week, what Chef Gordon Ramsay does is he comes into a restaurant that is completely not successful. It's just completely messed up in a lot of different areas, and he tries to fix it up. He tries to repair the situation and make it work better. Well, this last week, he was at a restaurant called Sebastian's in Los Angeles. And Sebastian was a guy who had a menu that he thought was unique and phenomenal and awesome. It was, in his mind, the best menu ever invented in the history of restaurateurism. And it was a selection of 20 gourmet flavor choices that you mixed and matched for your individual customized meal. And so he would have like multiple marinades, multiple kinds of beef, multiple kinds of chicken, multiple kinds of vegetables. And it was just a gigantic menu listing all the different gourmet flavors that you could use. And then you were responsible to choose and mix and match all those different kinds of things. Now, if you have any idea about how the mathematics of that work, in order to find out what your choice is, you have to do something called a factorial. I'm giving you a little math lesson today. To figure out how many different kinds of food options there are on this menu, you would do 20 times 19 times 18 times 17, all the way down to 1, and that's the total number of food options that you would have at Sebastian's restaurant. In other words, the most complex menu ever imagined by humankind. And he thought this was the way to be successful in Los Angeles. He even thought about franchising this method, and it was all about franchising. Well, Gordon Ramsay came in, and he looked at the menu, and the problem wasn't just that the menu was complicated. The problem was that the guy didn't know how to cook. And so everything that came out looked like dog food. And so what Ramsay did was he said, we're going to simplify. You have these wood-burning stoves in your restaurant, and we're going to make pizzas. And so he took this guy's multiple-page menu, condensed it down into one sheet of paper, handed it back to him, and he said, this is what we're doing. We're going to make four different types of pizzas. We're going to have these other things, and there you go. Simple, straightforward, restaurant kind of situation. And I saw that, and I was realizing something, that we think choice and freedom is a good thing until we're confronted with an abundance of it. And then we begin to say, what in the world is this all about? I found a guy online, his name is Barry Schwartz, and he did a presentation at a place called TED. I don't know if you're familiar with TED. It's a conference that happens every year. And this particular conference where Barry Schwartz was at was in Oxford, England. And he wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. And to kind of set up what we're going to be talking about today, I'd like to show you about a minute and a half clip from Barry Schwartz's talk. It's kind of boring, but he makes an interesting point, and so I want you to just listen up. It's only about a minute and 30 seconds long. Okay, let's see if it works. Talk to you about some stuff that's in this book of mine
that I hope will resonate with other things that you've already heard, and I'll try to make some connections myself in case you miss them. But I want to start with what I call the official dogma. The official dogma of what? The official dogma of all Western industrial societies. And the official dogma runs like this. If we are interested in maximizing the welfare of our citizens, the way to do that is to maximize individual freedom. The reason for this is both that freedom is in and of itself good, valuable, worthwhile, essential to being human, and because if people have freedom, then each of us can act on our own to do the things that will maximize our welfare, and no one has to decide on our behalf. The way to maximize freedom is to maximize choice. The more choice people have, the more freedom they have, and the more freedom they have, the more welfare they have. This, I think, is so deeply embedded in the water supply that it wouldn't occur to anyone to question it.
Over the rest of Barry Schwartz's presentation, he begins to question that very dogma himself. And he begins to identify how when you add additional choices into the mix, you actually decrease happiness. You actually decrease satisfaction. Because we end up living in a world filled with noise, filled with distraction. Now, I have certain ADD tendencies. I do. And those of you who know me know that it is a sickness and a weakness of mine. And the biggest thing that I hate is that I am attracted to distraction. I have an attraction to distraction. It's very bad. I can be sitting down planning to work on one thing. And the next thing I know, I have spent an hour and a half doing four completely different things. And then I remember I was supposed to be doing that one thing. It's very hard for me to motivate myself to do the right thing at the right time all the time. And that's just me. I know, and that's just in a few areas of my life, but I know all of us have multiple areas in our lives that go on that line where it's like, I've got these choices and it's hard for me to maintain consistency in this particular area. Anyone who can maintain consistency in every area of their life is, well, I don't know, I'd like to meet them. Because I think if you can maintain consistency in every avenue of your life, well, you're doing some really good stuff. But we live in a world that is very noisy. Our society is constantly bombarding us with new choices and new options and things like that. In Barry Schwartz's talk, he says, as a cursory survey of his local grocery store, he identified 175 different salad dressings. And that did not include the 10 different olive oils and the 15 different balsamic vinegars, where if you were to buy them and combine them on your own with your own spices, the possibilities are endless. The thing that I want to raise to your attention and to my attention today is that in a world of increasing noise, we need to find out something simple. We need to find something essential. We need to find the core of what we need to focus on in our lives so that if we get those things right, everything else will fall into place. That's what I believe we need to get, and that's what we're going to be looking at today, because Jesus teaches us something. And he says this, the entire teaching of the Bible, I'm paraphrasing a whole series of Jesus' teaching, to say this, the entire teaching of the Bible can be summarized in four simple principles or commands. Jesus teaches these four simple principles, these four commands. And we're going to be looking at them today as our essentials. I'll be going until about 11:45, and we're going to dig into this, so pay attention, follow along, we're going to have some fun here. The first and most important principle that Jesus teaches is this. Simply put, love God. I've got the verse printed here on your note sheet. Would you look at it with me? It's in Mark 12, verses 28 through 31. Jesus is approached by a scholar, and the scholar says, Teacher, tell us, what is the most important commandment? And he replies, The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And then in Matthew 22, he adds an extra line at the end of this phrase. In Matthew 22, he says, all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. All the law and the prophets. Now, when Jesus says that, he means the entire Old Testament. Law and the prophets was sort of an idiomatic way of Jesus' day to refer to the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. And so when he says all the law and the prophets hang on these two commands, he means the entire Old Testament can be distilled into these two statements, these two commands. It's also very interesting that he calls it no commandment is greater than these. In other words, he uses the singular and the plural, and he just kind of mashes them together because he recognizes that you cannot do one without also doing the other. I'm going to talk about them separately. We're talking about loving God first, and secondly, you can already see, we're going to be talking about loving your neighbor as yourself. But I want to just draw your attention to this fact that when Jesus says, what's the most important commandment, what's the most important thing for us to do, he says, love God. That's the top of the list. Around here, we've got a series of four core values. And that's what we like to focus on. Some of you have heard me talk about these a lot, and I tell you, I'm probably going to talk about them three or four times a year for the rest of my life, until the day I die. Because all of life can be summarized by these four commandments. That means everything I need to do in life can be summarized by four simple core values. And the first core value is God Himself. When God comes first, I believe this, the bottom of my heart, when God comes first, everything else falls into place. That doesn't mean everything in your life is going to work out exactly the way you want it to. It doesn't mean everything in your life is just going to all of a sudden snap and now it's going to work for me. It's going to make me feel good. It's all going to be happy. No, it means everything's going to fall into place, which means perspective. You're going to understand what this part of my life has to do because God is coming first. Our lives are going to get put into perspective. And I think that's important. The other thing I want to say about this is that Jesus uses a phrase that was uncomfortable with me when I was younger. He uses the phrase, he doesn't say put God first. That's easy enough to do. He doesn't say obey God. That's, you know, straightforward enough to understand. What he says is love God. When I was a kid, there was a song that we sang in church. Actually, I think it was kind of my Sunday school children's church program. And it went like this. I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice to worship you. Oh, my soul, rejoice. And I learned how to play it on the piano. And it was my favorite song. I absolutely loved it because I thought the melody was just so simple, so clear. I haven't sung it in a long time, but it was a very simple, straightforward song. I loved it. My favorite song. But I would go to bed at night. Now, mind you, I'm weird, okay? I really am. I have this odd, strange mental process thing going on that you would not believe. And I would go to bed at night as like an 8-year-old thinking to myself, I really like that song, but I don't really know what it means. Because I don't know what it means to love God emotionally. You know what I mean? I don't know what it means to connect with God on an emotional level. I didn't understand. Because my mom, she would come into my bedroom and she'd look at the mess and she'd say, Jeff, would you clean up this room for crying out loud? If you loved me, you would just do what I said. And I'd be like, well, I know how to do what you say, but I don't even know. Because, I mean, this is my mom. I'm supposed to love her, right? I'd go away to camp, and I'd be like, yeah, I love you, Mom. I miss you. But I didn't know what that meant. Because I'm very weird. Sometimes I've got this cold heart thing going on. And God's been chiseling it away for many years. And I'm going to get to some of that in just a little bit. But at the time, when I was, like, really young, I was like, what is this love thing all about? Jesus says, love God. I want to try to unpack that for you a little bit. And the first one is the one that I found very difficult to understand, but it is the heart or the emotional piece. When Jesus says love God, he does mean the emotion. And so here's the phrase I'd like for you to sort of write down and remember. How I feel is colored by an overall desire for God. We have a lot of feelings that run through our heads and hearts. Lots of feelings. But when Jesus says the first and most important commandment is to love God with all your heart, that means everything that passes through my heart, everything, has to be colored and fashioned and shaped by an overall desire for God above other things. To say, I want to be near God, I want to know God, I want to connect with God. This happened for me when I was in junior high, just crossing into high school. I went to a mission trip to Mexico, a city called Tecate. And while I was there, I had spent, like I said, you know, multiple years not really knowing what it meant to love God emotionally, even to love my mom or anything like that. I would say the words, I believed the words, but I didn't know what it felt like emotionally. And one of the things that was my problem was that I also hated music. Because music was all emotional, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. Well, I went to this mission trip, and as a freshman in high school, I was on this trip, and there was a guy up in front leading worship on a guitar. I had made a promise to God the previous year that I would never in my life do something so foolish or embarrassing as to stand up in front of people and play music and play the guitar and try to coerce and cajole them into joining me in such nonsense. I thought it was just completely ludicrous. I made a promise to God that I'd never do it. And here I was sitting in this room, and this guy was up front, and I said to myself this, I don't know what it really means to love God, but other people do. And I'm going to throw myself into it to see what happens. And I made a commitment that week to just start singing loud. And God began doing something in my heart as I was singing these words, engaging with the music. He began to speak to my heart about what this stuff really meant, what it was all about on an emotional level. And it didn't really break through until later on that week when I was challenged by the speaker to find another person and to pray with them. And I was, you know, I'm a freshman in high school. I was a little nervous and intimidated by all this other stuff going on. And so the speaker up front says, now go find someone else in this room and sit down and pray with them. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to find some stranger and sit down and pray with them on some topic that this guy up front just told me. But at the end of the evening, as he was closing in prayer, I said a little prayer in my heart. And I said, God, if you want me to pray with someone, I need you to bring them to me. I'll even be willing to say the first word, but when I open my eyes, they've got to be coming towards me. Now, trust me, God does not answer immediate prayers like that all the time. But when I opened my eyes, there was someone meandering towards my direction. Not necessarily walking to me, not necessarily approaching me, but coming in my direction, facing me. And I went ahead and said, God, I'm going to give you credit for that. I'm going to talk to this person. And I said, you want to pray? And the person said, yes, there's a group of us getting together right now. We're going to climb up onto the roof of this building and we're going to pray up there. And I was in a whirlwind of people who were passionate about prayer, who were doing something that I thought was cool. They were climbing on the roof of this building. And it was just weird, you know? It was like all of a sudden God just clicked a bunch of buttons for me that worked. And I was in amazement that God loved me enough to pay attention to silly, stupidness, weird requests, and to make something cool and fun and just awesome. That's transformed my life. From that moment on, I have understood at least a little bit of what it means to emotionally love God. But loving God is not just about our emotions. It's also God, Jesus says, love God with your heart and with your soul. That's the next one. What does it mean to love someone with your whole soul? The word I use for that is the word of intimacy. To say, if I'm going to love someone with my soul, that means everything I am, everything that I would call Jeff, everything that you would call you bring to the table into this relationship. If you're loving someone with your whole soul, you're loving someone as you. Nothing hidden, nothing fake, nothing pretentious. It's just you. That's intimacy. And so this is the phrase. How I relate is shaped by a closeness with God. Every aspect of my soul, every aspect of who I am, is shaped by a closeness with God. Jesus also says, love God with your heart, love God with your soul, love God with your mind. Well, what's that one all about? Well, your mind clearly is the way you think. And so this is the phrase I have for that. How I think about things is bounded by the words of God. Say something about that. Do you realize that it is impossible for you to love God with your whole mind unless your mind is completely colored by what God has said? I'll try to illustrate this for you a little bit. When I was in college, my senior year, I had met this girl the previous summer. And my junior year, actually, I met this girl the previous summer. Her name was Jennifer. And I fell madly in love with her. It was like magic. And it was just wild. And I was Twitter-pated for my whole junior year in college. Messed up. It was cool. And what we did is, since she was going to school in Purdue and I was going to school up in Chicago at a place called Wheaton, we emailed each other. And luckily, in 1996, Al Gore had already invented the internet. And so we were able to email each other, and we did this thing called Y-Talk, which was sort of like the ancient form of AOL Instant Messenger, where you could chat back and forth with each other. I gave her my login name and my password, so she would sometimes log on to my computer from Purdue here, and she would do cutesy little things to my computer, and then I would log into her computer, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I didn't do anything, but then, you know, I'd just kind of say hi or whatever, and so we'd kind of go back and forth. But I tell you what, every time I got an email from her, my world stopped. Everything stopped. Every time I got one of these tiny little white talk messages, the world shut down. I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. It was all about those words. Because if I was going to love her, I was going to love her with every part of me, including my mind. And if she was going to say a word to me, I was going to just drink it up. Phone conversations were amazing. Emails were awesome. And I believe God wants us to treat his word that way. He's speaking to us constantly, 100% of the time, right here in the pages of this book, and also to our hearts if we are close enough to him to be able to discern his voice. He's speaking to us, and we need to let our minds be completely colored by his words. Putting God first in your life also means putting his word first in our lives. And then finally, Jesus says, heart, soul, mind, and strength. Strength is our actions. Or this is the phrase I use, how I use what I have is expanded by the desires of God. Not my own desires. See, this is the thing. We have stuff. We have money. We have strength. We have ability. We have talents. We have time. We have all these things. And we use these things based on our desires. So, I mean, I spend my time mostly the way I want to spend my time. Now, there are some times where I have to do what someone else tells me to do. There's some times when I have to, just sort of go along with someone else's time frame, someone else's desires or something. But in most cases, I generally do what I choose to do with my life. You pretty much do the same thing too. Even if you have a boss who's very hard on you, you have chosen to stick with that job. And you have your reasons. Maybe this job is really great, aside from this particular situation. Maybe the job really stinks, but at least it's paying for your bills to, you know, at the end of every month. Whatever it is, we all have our choices. We all make our choices. We do things based on our desires. But if we're going to love God with our strength, that means we have to use what we've got based on his desires. I hate doing the dishes. I hate them. They're the world's most annoying practice. I have friends here in this church who have completely boycotted dishes altogether. They are 100% paper and plastic family. I don't have anything to say about their, you know, environmental habits, but they are 100% a paper and plastic family for this one reason alone, and I resonate with it. I hate doing the dishes, but I tell you what, if I know that my wife wants the dishes to be done, which is pretty much all the time, I often, though not all the time, will choose to do them even though I don't want to do them. Because I use what I have, the ability I have, my time, my resources, my strength, whatever, to meet the desires of someone else. And that's what we're called to with God. And I spend a lot of time on this because it is the fundamental core. It is the number one. If God comes first, everything else falls into place. And frankly, if we got number one solid, we would never have to pay attention to number two, three, or four. Because if we love God, then we would naturally do what comes next, which is love those He's made. Love our neighbor as ourselves. That's what Jesus says is the second greatest commandment. I was thinking about this the last couple of days, and, you know, Jesus says love your neighbor as yourself. And we live in a society that has shaped that thinking. So that I have frequently in Christian circles heard phrases like this. You can't love your neighbor unless you find out how to love yourself. There are people who say that. Or they might say something like, I need to work on loving myself first so that then I can figure out later on how to love my neighbor. Modern psychology is all into loving yourself. I did a quick Google search on just the phrase, love yourself. And I came up with this. 2,420,000 links for love yourself. There's how to love yourself clothing, how to love yourself again, learning to love yourself, inspirational affirmation cards to comfort, encourage, and inspire. Love yourself affirmation cards, or love, learning to love yourself. It's all over. People are all about the loving yourself. I clicked on one of these links. And I got fortherapy.com. And this lady says, on learning to love yourself, she says, most of you have probably heard Whitney Houston sing the words, learning to love yourself. It is the greatest love of all. And so it is. I believe it is what all of us need, yet it's what so few of us truly have. How is it that we don't love ourselves? And how do we learn to love ourselves? And of course, her whole article is then talking about the reasons we don't love ourselves and why we should love ourselves. Friends, when I was younger, I heard a little tiny phrase that some kids in my school used. When one person would make fun of another person, the person who was on the receiving end of the negative treatment would say this phrase. He would say, God doesn't make trash. And that phrase kind of stuck with me. God doesn't make trash. Friends, listen, I'm going to say something that's not necessarily politically correct or psychologically kosher. You don't have to spend any time learning to love yourself. What you need to do is pour out your heart to loving God. Because when you fully connect with loving God, you will naturally begin to love what He loves. And you know what? He loves you. You will naturally begin to understand that God values you. You don't have to put yourself on a pedestal. God's already done it. He loves you enough to die for you. You don't have to work every morning by looking in the mirror and then say, you know, I'm good enough and I'm smart enough and gosh darn it, people like me. You don't have to do those things. You can just simply say, God, I love you with my whole heart. And God is going to let you know that He loves you too. But when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, He's focusing on the neighbor part. He's not saying you need to spend more time learning to love yourself. He's saying you need to spend more time learning to love your neighbor. So when I was not quite sure how to love people, I had learned how to love God. But then the summer after my sophomore year in college, I wasn't quite sure how to love people. And I went out to California for this little excursion out there. And I prayed. I said, God, you're either going to have to... I was having this weird issue with, you know, being in California. I was supposed to be an intern, a worship leader intern at a church. And I was trying to make some money so I could live out there and not, you know, just die and starve or whatever. And I was out there, but I was having these issues with the whole women relationship situation. I said, God, you're either going to have to bring the one woman for me or just remove the desires and thoughts completely so I can focus on this experience in my life. A couple weeks later, I ran into Jennifer. And my whole world changed. And God actually created in me a love for her that I never knew existed. And so then all of a sudden I understood how to love one other person. And then over time, God expanded my horizons by teaching me how to love a couple other people. Until the time when my first son was born, my first child, a son, his name is Charlie, and I gave him a digital camera at one point so you could see just how great he looks. That's him taking a self-portrait. And another one, and one more. I love him. I gave him a little digital camera a couple years back, and he took some pictures. But I tell you something. When he was really little, see, I grew up and I had this stuffed animal, Winnie the Pooh, and I thought it was awesome. And I was attached to it. And I knew that if my son was anything like me, he'd probably get attached to stuffed animal too. And Jen and I talked, and we actually had this conversation. We said, okay, if he gets attached to a stuffed animal, what stuffed animal do we want it to be? You know, and that'll be the one that we make sure he's primarily with. He's primarily around, and if he gets attached to it, that's the one he gets attached to. And so we went to the store, and we bought this cute little lion, and we gave him this awesome name. We called him Quincy. He's a floppy little lion, kind of like a Beanie Baby, but a little bit bigger, and a real cushy, soft middle, you know, fuzzy hair. Awesome, and I know you're looking up on the screen wondering if I'm going to show the picture, and I don't have a picture because he lost it. We were in Evanston for some who knows why reason, and we were walking around with the stroller, and Charlie was there snuggling Quincy in his arms, and the next thing we knew, we looked down, and Quincy was gone. But I think Jen and I were far more attached to Quincy than Charlie was. He was a year old at the time, and just over a year and a half or something, and Quincy was gone, and we panicked, like, what are we going to do? Well, my mom, when Charlie was an infant, had given him a bunny. And he can probably hear me upstairs, so I'll be quiet. I never really liked the bunny. It was like a Peter Rabbit situation with the blue vest. And when you shook him, he had a rattle in his head. Stuffed bunny about that big. And I hate animals with rattles in them. Stuffed bunnies. But we'd shake him, just rattle out. Quincy was gone. Charlie started spending more time. Baby bunny. And I was like, oh. I said, Jen, we gotta find another Quincy. We went online, we started shopping hard. And you know what? They don't make him anymore. The company that produced that animal no longer exists. And so, more and more time went past with Charlie and Baby Bunny. Baby Bunny got more ragged and messed up. Fur started coming out. Last year, I should just show you the picture. This is Charlie taking pictures of Baby Bunny. There he is. There's another one right there. You can see his vest here is falling to pieces, basically. The fluffing is all matted on the inside. It's just little tiny balls of fluff. And it's not even soft, really, anymore. The rattle works. This last year, Baby Bunny developed a hole in his chest patch. And I spent $15 to find a seamstress here in Lafayette who would put another patch of white cloth right around here. You know why? Because Charlie loves Baby Bunny. And I love Charlie. And I'll do whatever it takes to protect what he loves. God loves you. And he loves everybody around you. And if you love God, you will love what he loves. A couple notes on this I'd like you to just write down. How do we love other people biblically? Quickly, these are some biblical principles. Number one, I choose to seek the best for others. I choose to seek the best for others. Number two, I choose to do life with others. There are hermits in this world who go to their grave alone in their houses. And God does not want us to be that way. He's called us to do life in relationship with other people. And we have to make the conscious choice to invest in those relationships. And so number three, I choose to work the relationship. That means to go through the hard times of forgiveness and reconciliation. To go through the hard times of annoying each other. And to just simply work the relationship. God is calling us to love other people. And this is what it takes. Now friends, if we did command number one, command number two would naturally follow. And if we did command number one and command number two, we wouldn't have to worry about the rest of these. But Jesus takes special time to give us two more. These are going to go pretty quickly, but this next one is simply this. Jesus says, follow me. You know, love makes people do silly things. When I fell in love with Jen, it was a one-week whirlwind kind of situation where it was about a month before she left California and I had to come back to college. And so we had about a couple weeks just together there. And the first week was like the week where all the magic started to happen. And I remember one night where we went out to a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Beautiful evening, sunset, everything. The water was below us about 100 feet or so. And we were up there on the cliff a few yards back from the edge, just sitting there listening to the ocean, talking to each other. And at one point, I reached over and I took her hand. It was the first time we held hands. And this is just completely sappy. It's like, I'm telling you, a romantic comedy kind of movie. And so the girls out here are going like, aw. And the guys are like, oh, come on. But anyway, so, love makes you do silly things, like take someone's hand. And on the way home, I was driving. And I was driving this red Honda Accord LX 1986 stick shift kind of situation. My dad's favorite car. Awesome car. I love the car too. Stick shift though. She's in the seat over here. I'm driving a stick shift. What do you do if you want to keep holding hands? It was annoying. I couldn't figure it out. And so I was holding her hands. But you know what happened on the way home? I accidentally ran a red light. Completely. I didn't even see it. It was like I was drunk. I was not even paying attention to the road. Completely blew through a red light. It's a good thing it was 11:30 at night. And so no one else was on the road, especially no cops. Blew right through it. And then right after I saw the red go over my head, I was like, oh no, she's not going to date me anymore because I just ran a red light. And so I looked over at her and I was like, I am so sorry. Did I just run that red light? And she said, yeah, you did. And I said, I'm so sorry. And I looked up and another one, whoosh. I went through two red lights, like right in a row, just like that. I hate that. It was so annoying. Love makes you do silly things, including following people, going where they would go and doing what they would do. And so that's what I'm going to talk about with Jesus. Because Jesus looks at his followers and he says, do this. He says, follow me. Following Jesus means, first of all, going where he goes. Matthew 9:9. Jesus saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. Awesome. Really simple. Jesus says, follow me. And Matthew does it. Gets up and follows him. Number two, following Jesus means doing what he does. John 13:15, Jesus says, I've set you an example that you should do as I've done for you. Doing what he does. Real quick, when I was in Chicago, I met a lot of people with foreign names. There was a man named, it was Olu, and his nickname was Olu, but his full name was Olumiyi, and his last name was Ajiboye, and his wife's name was Folasade, and then that was one family. There was another family with Ravi and Jayashila Kanagala, and there was another family, Sunil Kaushal, and then there was Pramila. There were a lot of very interesting names of people that I ran into while I was in Chicago. And I made a point to show love to people by trying to learn their names. So that when they would come up to me and they would tell me their name, I would say it back to them. And more than one occasion, people would say to me, you're the first white person, although they wouldn't say it like that, you're the first person who's actually been able to pronounce my name. And I learned this technique. You just simply say exactly what they said. When you ask them their name and they tell you something that sounds like gobbledygook, you say the gobbledygook. And then they say, you got it. You understood my name. Because see, this is the problem. What we usually do is when someone tells us their name or something like that, in English it's okay. We do this all the time. You don't even know you do it, but you do it. What we do is we filter the name in our head. Transform it in our head to something we can relate to. If someone says their name is John, we think of a person we knew named John. We transform it in our head, put it into a place where we are comfortable with that thing, and then we speak it back out from our filter. And so when you're talking to someone who's got a foreign language, they might say their name is Ayodeji, and then you would respond with Ayodeji or something. And you're not repeating it exactly the way they say it, because you're filtering it through what I already know. Listen, Jesus doesn't say filter me. He says do what I do. We've filtered Jesus for so long. I think perhaps maybe we as people need to start just doing what he did. Reading what he says and start actually doing it and see what happens. Following Jesus means doing what he did. Let's keep going. There's another verse here. Matthew 16:24. Jesus says to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Even to the point of death, doing what Jesus did. Following Jesus also means focusing on him over everything else. Focusing on him over everything else. John 21:21. When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about him? Talking about John, another guy. What about that guy? And Jesus answered, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. Jesus had just told Peter he was going to die and that people were going to kill him. And so Peter instantly does what you and I would do. He looks over at John and he says, well, Jesus, what about John? How's John going to die? Who's killing him? You tell me the Romans are killing me. Who's killing John? And Jesus says, hang on there, buddy. If I want him to live for 1,000 years, what's that to you? You follow me. See, this is the thing. When we follow Jesus, it's not about following Jesus the way other people follow Jesus. It's not about following Jesus so that other people get manipulated too. It's about just following Jesus. You look at Jesus and you say, what is Jesus saying to me? I'm doing it 100%. That's our third core value. We call it growth because we're trying to become like Jesus. And one verse for number four is simply this. Make disciples. Matthew 28:19-20. Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, Jesus says, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age. Jesus says there are four core essential things that if you get these right, everything else falls into place. If you look through the entire teaching of Jesus from beginning to end, and then you look at the entire teaching of the Bible, you see these same four things are clearly represented from beginning to end. Put God first in your life. Love him more than anything else. Heart, soul, mind, and strength. Number two, let that flow out into loving other people. Number three, follow Jesus and become what you are not yet. Become who Jesus is causing you to become, where he is taking you. Follow him completely. In the Old Testament, it was following the law. Today, we get to follow Jesus himself directly. Follow him. And then finally, the last core value, the last command, the last essential, Jesus says, do it for others. Reproduce yourself. He says, make disciples, baptizing them and teaching them to do everything I've commanded you. In other words, everything Jesus has done for you, do for them. Everything Jesus has done to make you who you are, to bring you to a point of becoming a follower of him, you do for others. It's a cycle that reproduces itself. If we love God more than anything else, we will love what he loves, including other people. If we love other people, then we will become more and more like Jesus and be able to follow Jesus the way he led us. And if we do those things, we will begin to have, and then we begin to share that with other people so that they can love him too. I've got a diagram that I like to use for this purpose, and this will be the last thing I say today. But if you take four dots and kind of have our core values represented with each one of the dots, right at the top you would say, love God. I'm going to put God first in my life. God comes before everything else. If He's in first place, everything else falls into place. Then what we do is we love other people out of our love for God. And out of our love for God, then we begin to love other people. And then finally, or next, we follow Jesus. And we say, I'm going to become more like Jesus. It's not just about me loving other people. I'm going to let God sink into my heart and transform me. And then the next essential is to do that for other people. To reproduce myself into the lives of others so that they love God too. It makes a cycle. You get these four things right, everything else in life fits. Because this is a cycle from beginning to end. I love God, the rest of the world loves God. God is love, it's all about Him anyway. This is in fact the message of the cross. Jesus, on the cross, spreads His arm wide to say, I love the world. I love you, and I want you to love the rest of the world too. I love you, and I want you to reproduce my love and your love into the lives of others. Putting God first is to say He's at the top. But when God intersects with the dirt of my life, I change, and I become more like Jesus. And so if you get these four things right, your life is going to be solid. If our church gets these four things right, we are going to be solid. And the sky is the limit for what God can do in our midst if we can be a people who are completely committed to these things. These are the essentials. Believe them. Live them. Let them change your life. Would you pray with me? God, we just ask that You would make this stuff come alive to us. You would teach us this week what it means to get these things right. Especially, Lord, as we're coming to the end of this month, the beginning of the fall season, and more people are going to be looking to reconnect with You and to reconnect with churches, and we're going to see more people come into this place. Especially as we go through the process of our launching phase two with a changed name as a church, a new kind of identity feel as we're trying to reach the people here in Lafayette with the knowledge that You love them. God, as we do those things, we believe You're going to bring people into our fellowship, into our context. And God, would You help us to get these four things right? These are the essentials as Jesus taught them. Would You help us to get them right? Now as your head is bowed, I want to ask you to just pull out that communication card and flip it over to the blank back side and kind of think about this question for just a moment. The question is this: where are you in this journey? Loving God, loving others, becoming more like Jesus, reproducing, helping other people to love God too. And what part of this process, what part of this cycle are you right now? For some of you who've been Christians for a long time, maybe you're all the way back up at the top. You've swung around the loop, and now you need to work on your own heart's condition, your own love for God. For some of you who've just entered into this, perhaps you need to say, it's time for me to start reproducing a little bit and to share with other people what I know. It's not a process where you start one place and you end another place. It's a cycle. We keep living this out. These are the four things we live out all over the place. So as we sing this final song, as our offering gets passed, before we sing this final song, before our offering gets passed, we're going to take just a brief moment of silence. And I want to invite you to jot down on that card where you are. Your connection with God. What is He leading you to work on? Take just a moment in silence, you and God right now.